Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Spectacular. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm getting my preparations ready for the holidays.
As we all are.
And, you know, as we set up the restaurant for New Year's Eve, I want to talk about New Year's Eve. We should let everybody know that what we've been doing for the last several years and what we're going to do again is something that's increasing in popularity. We have the restaurant guys actually shoot fireworks off the roof of the Heldrich Hotel in the middle of downtown New Brunswick at the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve, and that's great for all the restaurants in New Brunswick. You can go to newbrunswicknewyearseve.com and find out about that. And you know, that's a fun thing that we do as a city, but I want to talk about how New Year's Eve has sort of changed and evolved, and I think that we were in the restaurant business for the New Year's Eve shot heard around the world.
2000.
With the dawn of the new millennium.
2000, for sure.
It changed everything. And then, of course, the crash of 2008 just put the final nail in the coffin of what used to be. I always remember New Year's Eve from when I was a kid. My parents would get people to throw lavish parties.
Yep.
You know, if you were the kind of person to ever go black tie, that was the night you did it. Champagne, big bands, ballroom dancing, lights.
Well, there was also the other faction was, you know, go someplace and drink your face off.
Right, of course.
Was the other side.
Right, but it was all about decadence. And, you know, I used to like to work New Year's Eve because, frankly, you know, people drank too much on New Year's Eve. It was excess, you know. And there was also always back then this expectation that New Year's was the night to be the best night. It had to be the best night of the year. And, you know, if you weren't with somebody, it was almost worse than not being with somebody on Christmas. I knew people who were, like, depressed because, like,
or
I have a boyfriend, I don't have a girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And because you want to kiss somebody at midnight. But what I found was, and what we worked against in owning our own restaurant, we'd have a band, and it was fun, and it was dinner, but we'd hire a 10-piece band, right? But I was off one New Year's Eve from the time I was 21 until, well, since I was 21. Mm-hmm. And I went out to dinner. I went to the city. I went out with good friends who were also bartenders in the business, and we went to a place, and it was like, it was good, you know? But there's such an expectation that it's going to be spectacular that it just falls flat. You know, it's like,
you know how to make it not fall flat?
Uh-huh.
Blow stuff up off a roof.
Yeah, that's true.
It's really working.
Well, but, you know, I think what changed that, I don't know if you guys remember, but they were predicting there was going to be a champagne shortage at midnight.
Oh, yeah.
Turn into 2000.
See, if you were in the business, that was part of the deal. You know, you better get your champagne in November that year or October because there was going to be a champagne shortage.
I knew a sales rep who worked for a wine distribution company who convinced the wine buyer for a major sports arena that they were gonna run out of champagne. The guy bought 5 pallets of champagne in August.
Gracious.
He bought 2-year supply of champagne. And you know what? There was no freaking shortage. Champagne everywhere. There's never a shortage. Good for you. There's gonna be a shortage on Stage Left entrees. Everybody hurry up and get one.
January 2nd. Everybody wants some champagne.
So what happened was, I don't, if y'all remember, New Year's Eve, 99 into 2000, was a dud. People were afraid of terrorism, and restaurants that had planned these lavish things canceled them. Mm-hmm. And it never quite came back. Never. And you know what? Kind of to the good, you know? And what we did was we'd get a band, and we'd have dinner and a band. Or we'd have a jazz concert, so you'd go and see a concert.
Right. So yeah, for years we did the dinner and a band, then we started the jazz concert.
At the Crossroads Theater, which was still an expense, and people were really still willing to spend money on New Year's Eve. But the whole, like, the New Year's Eve party, it was always, it was such a high, it was like the prom every year. As an adult, you went to the prom, and it was always a disappointment. And, but what's happened?
The prom was not a disappointment for me.
I'm sorry.
Francis has just given you a little bit of insight into his life, I think.
I didn't
go to the prom. For most of us, the prom was wonderful, Francis.
My friend Shelly and I went out to dinner. We were like, prom, schmom. I was kind of like the Pretty in Pink movie was my life in high school.
Yeah.
and you were Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I know. So, so what has changed since 08, though, is we looked at 08, and I don't know what everybody's doing on New Year's Eve anymore, because it just strikes me as people are really leery to invest a lot emotionally into New Year's Eve. And I think people are having quiet dinners at home, they're going out to dinner, and we did the we got everybody in town together to put these fireworks off the hotel, because what we wanted was, what we do, we have a wine dinner for, you know, maybe 50 people come to the wine dinner, which you start at 8:30, and then you get out and watch the fireworks. Other restaurants may do something similar to that.
Yeah, and we also have regular dinner, so you can do whatever you want. It can be as low-key or high-key, and I think that's what people were yearning for when the market crashed. They were looking for something low-key, but they still wanted to celebrate the moment.
And, you know, I think that's hopefully how these fireworks work for all the restaurants in New Brunswick. If you want to go to Duimari or the Frog and the Peach or any place, because we're all in walking distance. That's a great thing that we have in our little town. Mm-hmm. And so what I think what a lot of people are doing is New Year's Eve, come to our great restaurant, have a nice dinner, and then go watch the Boom Boom at midnight. And I think that's the tenor of the time, and I kind of like that better. Mm-hmm. I really, really do. There's too much pressure otherwise on New Year's Eve.
It's really nice, and the what you do have there is you do have the excitement of ringing in the new year without, you know, all the pomp and circumstance, I guess.
Yeah. I think there's been a sea change in the tenor of that holiday that we're going to see stay for many, many years.
And I don't know. I think that when times are good again, you'll see people, you know, celebrate it more. Right now, we're starting to see people celebrate more again, but...
But I think
the last few years, I think, have been tough on a lot of people, and it's hard to celebrate the new year when you've had such a tough last year.
I think that when people are celebrating this, though, they want to celebrate it in a low-key way. Mm-hmm. I think that it was always just a touch fake, a touch too much. Anyway, so there you go. That's how we feel. If you want to come watch fireworks at midnight, you don't even have to come to the restaurant. Just come watch fireworks at midnight in downtown New Brunswick. And whatever we're doing, I hope you have a great New Year's. We're going to talk in a moment to Sean Muldoon, one of my favorite Irish restaurateurs, and he's going to open a bar in New York shortly called The Dead Rabbit, and you'll hear about that in just a second. Stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, and our guest today is a man named Sean Muldoon. You may have heard us speak about Sean on the show before. He is the creative force behind the Connoisseurs Club at the Merchant Hotel in Ireland, and he is opening a bar in New York City as we speak.
Sean Muldoon, welcome to the show.
Hi.
So, Sean, you had enough of Ireland? You decided to come to New York?
Yeah, well, in Ireland, we sort of got as far as we could go, and... we basically had won a lot of awards, and I'd been at the place for 5 years, and an investor came along one time, a guy who was a regular customer of ours, and he said, listen, what are you going to do? Are you going to win another award, or are you going to go where it really is? Where we need to do our stuff is in New York and Belfast. So at first I thought it was practically impossible. I didn't believe it was going to be possible to get here, but he made it possible. So that was 2.5 years ago.
If that investor has enough money, all things are possible. Yeah, we do it all the time. Every Saturday night, somebody comes up to me and Mark. They're like, hey, listen, I got a million laying around. You want to open a bar in another city? And we're like, no, we like New Brunswick. You know, your bar, and we didn't meet for years after I started going to your bar, but your bar, the bar that you got behind at Bill Woolsey's Hotel in the Merchant Hotel in Belfast, you won, under your tutelage, it won Tales of the Cocktail, World's Best Cocktail Bar, World's Best Hotel Cocktail Bar, World's Best Drink Selection, and World's Best Cocktail List at like the Emmy Awards of the of the restaurant and bar community. That's pretty hefty accomplishment.
I actually, Sean, remember flying back on the airplane, sitting next to the person from the Merchant. I don't remember if it was you or not, honestly, but I remember very distinctly whoever was holding the award was holding them preciously on his lap in the flight from New Orleans to New York and then back to Ireland. And they were just sitting there and like, don't come near me. Don't touch me. No, I don't want to drink. I'm just holding my award.
I can tell you a funny story about that. That was actually Jack McGarry.
Uh-huh.
He's my business partner in the Dead Rabbit, and he was sort of like the head bartender in the Merchant. And basically what happened that year that those awards were on, they were held in a casino in New Orleans. And the legal drinking age is strictly 21 down there. And Jack... and especially in that casino. And Jack grew a beard because Jack hadn't turned 21 yet.
Mm.
He grew a beard and everything. He was desperate to get into the awards that night, and he couldn't get in because the guy said, your beard doesn't fool me, kid. And he couldn't get in. So I had to go into the awards myself. And when we won, I basically handed the awards over to him because I was going on. I had to go back home to London. I had to go to London.
You know, one thing that Mark and I talked about is like, what do the Irish have against bubble wrap? What's the problem? I don't get that. I definitely would have. I thought, you know, Sean Muldoon's going to kill that man if he drops those plates on the way back there in the plane. So I would like to talk to you about cocktails in Ireland. You know, we have our cocktail bar in New Brunswick, New Jersey, which is kind of an unlikely place. And we've been doing it for a long time. We've been doing it for 20 years, real cocktails in New Brunswick, New Jersey. So I would say that we were slightly ahead of the curve. And as cocktails became nationally and internationally important, cities like New York and London and then later Chicago and San Francisco became great cocktail cities. New Brunswick, except for us, took a while to really get there, and it took a while for folks to understand what we were doing. We basically had a, like, we offered a thing that wasn't being offered, and we had to sort of educate people and teach them why it was great, you know? And for those not familiar with Ireland, Northern Ireland in particular, Belfast in particular, it wasn't exactly a place that was screaming for a cocktail bar. I mean, you brought something, you were ahead of your time there. I mean, still, there's not many great cocktail bars in Belfast.
No, well, to be quite honest, I wouldn't even say that there's any, apart from the merchant. Basically what happened was, I had been bartending, I've been bartending like 20, 21 years, full time, without breaks, without interruptions, and, I've worked in all kinds of different environments, all kinds of like from the corner pub to social clubs to five-star hotels to cruise ships. And basically what, it was a bit of a tragedy happened in my life in, 1997, and, I was already in bartending about 6 or 7 years at that point, and I decided that I took time out. Like, I mean, when I say time out, I took 2 or 3 weeks out, and I had to really rethink what I wanted to do in life. I didn't want to work in a corner pub anymore or anything like that. And I, during that 3 week, when I've been through the motions, I watched a program on television that was about this Italian furniture maker, and it really, really inspired me. This guy had given up. He was like a local carpenter making furniture for kids in some rural part of Italy, and he said that he was going to go for gold and go to the States, and him and his uncle came over and went over to the States, and they had it really, really hard at first, but the whole thing documented his life and the hardships, and he went on to become like some sort of a Christian Dior of the furniture world. And I remember reading or hearing on the television program that people like Madonna were waiting maybe 3 years and this guy making a custom made piece of furniture. It really, really, really made me evaluate my life and where I was going in life. And, it really made me tell me I compared that carpenter to my own father, who himself was a woodworker. But he didn't decide to go for broke, and he didn't, give up everything to chase his dream. And it made me realize that, and then, I guess it's 1997, 1998, that you can take any humble trade in the world and you can make it something totally extraordinary. It really is up to the individual. And, I looked at bargaining. It's something that I didn't take seriously at all up until that point. And it made me think that if he can do that with furniture, I can do that with bargaining. And I did not know how you became the world best in the world at bargaining. I had no idea, no comprehension of it. But it was during, I decided to give up the local pub and went to work for who was the best in Northern Ireland at that time, a guy called Jasmine. And it was during my time in Botanic Inns. There was this guy, a guy called Morgan Watson. He was a king bartender, big handsome guy that had just returned from South Africa. And he was always in the papers and all the girls fancied this guy. And I just remember thinking at the time, I want to be like that guy. And, this is 1998. And I just wanted what he had. And the one thing that he had that was different, he did cocktails. And the cocktails that he did back then were like Cosmopolitan, the Moo-Woos and things like that. But it was something that I'd never even seen before. And I just remember thinking, I want to be better than him. I want to aim for him, and I just want to surpass him. I think for me to be the best in the world, I need to be like him. And then I said that I got as far as I could in Botanic Inns, and I set up my own business, which was a consultancy business. And I sort of went to, I set up a lot of bars in Belfast. This is like sort of 2002, 2003, 2004. I set up bars, done cocktail programs, trained staff. And some of those bars won awards that Belfast had never won before, like the Theme Best in the UK award of cocktailist, whatever it was, or best bartender in the UK. And then I took a break and I went and worked in a cruise ship because I felt they'd come to the end of, I couldn't really get any further in Northern Ireland. I just literally hit that to the top of again. Bill Woolsey came along with an offer and he told me
Bill Woolsey is the owner of the Merchant Hotel.
Yeah. So he came along, hunted me out, he came along with an offer, and he said to me, I've been paying attention to you for a long time. Bill Woolsey basically said that this was the job that I've been waiting on. This job was designed for me. And he said that I could potentially do something amazing in Belfast with cocktails. And I said to him at the time, I said, there's one thing you've got to do. You've got to let me do it my way. You can't, and if you're the owner and stuff like that, I'll do everything within limits. Obviously, I'm not going to go out and spend all your money. But I need to have my direction. I need to have my focus. If I say we're going to do an ice program that nobody was doing back then, if I said we're going to do hand-cut ice or whatever, I said, you've got to listen to me. You've got to trust me. And I said, because it's not something that people in Belfast have ever done before, but you've just got to trust me. If you give me this job and you let me be, I said, I want to get the most talked about cocktail bar on the planet. I will give you awards that you never thought possible. I will bring such excitement to Belfast. I said, but you just got to trust me. And he basically trusted me. So the rest is history.
Here you go, and you open this bar. It is one of the best cocktail bars in the world. But you're in a city that has never seen anything like that before. How were you received by the... I guess there are two clienteles in a hotel. You have the guests who are maybe better traveled and, you know, have traveled in Europe and maybe seen that sort of thing before. But you've also got folks in Belfast themselves. And if people are sort of Belfast-focused, they've never seen anything like a cocktail bar when you opened The Merchant. Well, how were you received?
Well, first and foremost, it's important to say that the hotel itself, nobody's ever seen anything like that in Belfast. So I knew... It'd be different if I was introducing like a big serious cocktail program in a normal bar. Then it would have been very, very, I don't know if it would have worked or not, you know what I'm talking about? But because it was a 5-star hotel in the city center of Belfast, and because Bell Wolsey was going all out with decor and grandeur, I believed that I would be able to deliver a beverage program that would match the quality of the hotel. And therefore, people who might never have had a cocktail before would go into this bar and they would feel that maybe they would feel compelled to have a cocktail because they're in these fantastic surroundings and stuff like that. But in the early days, a lot of things I didn't set out, for example, give you an example, I didn't set out to have the world's most expensive cocktail. It wasn't part of my, we had the world's most expensive cocktail, I think it was in 2007. It was an original Trader Vic's Mai Tai that was made with Ray and Nephew 17-year-old rum. Now, as far as I was aware, we literally had one of the only bottles of that rum in existence. So we had this cocktail for £750, and I did not set out to have it the world's most expensive cocktail. It just sort of happened because I knew of the rarity of the rum, and I was able to get a bottle. And I knew also because people that have these most expensive cocktails, it's very gimmicky in many, many respects.
Sure,
I wanted to do a serious cocktail. It was actually for a true cocktail aficionado that was worthy of £750. So. The amount of press, for example, that one thing generated back in the day, we'd only been open like maybe 1 year, and the amount of press that generated in Belfast and in the world, people in Belfast felt that they had to go to The Merchant and they had to have a Mai Tai. They didn't have the expensive one, but they had to have a Mai Tai.
Did anybody order the expensive one? How long did it take till somebody actually ordered and paid for one of these?
I remember the moment very, very clearly. We had three cocktail guides during my time at The Merchant, four cocktail guides, but we started this bar book thing because we wanted to develop our menu into something that's going to be like a book that people could take home and have on the shelf and keep and cherish. Really, really, really well done menu. But the whole introduction to that book was about the sale of the first ever Mai Tai at The Merchant Hotel. And I just remember that night, the word got about all over the floor, all the waiters started whispering to the customers that they were serving, somebody's buying a Mai Tai, and all of a sudden, all the heads turned around, and you've seen the Mai Tai being served, and I mean, literally, you could have heard a pin drop in the room, because nobody believed somebody had actually bought it, and then all the taxi drivers, and all the hairdressers, and people like that were non-stop talking about this Mai Tai, and there's an open-top bus tour that drove past the site, an open-top bus, the tourist bus.
Yeah.
It drove past The Merchant, and they stopped it. They stopped the bus outside The Merchant to talk about the Mai Tai. And things like that really, really made The Merchant, like, it got it up there, and people were talking about this bar and the cocktail.
Sean, a lot of our listeners are in the business. So one of the things you said earlier in the show is you said you set about the task of becoming the best bartender in the world. How does one go about setting about the task of becoming the best bartender in the world?
Okay, so my thing is, it was not that I was a bartender, such like my partner Jack, he's a bartender. you've got to have a team behind you that fully, fully, fully believe in the vision. Yeah, I mean, if there's people there that do not believe in it, they shouldn't be there. Because from day one, I told people that I wanted to be the best in the world, and they were either on board with that or they weren't on board. And there's things like, there's certain standards you expect. I'll give you an example of something I'm talking about. The Mai Tai is our signature drink, and I remember one time, the way our bar worked, there was two cocktail servers, and then I would have done the pass, as we call it, the way it would work in the kitchen. So I was the guy that worked at the dispense bar at the weekend, but every single drink made at the bar had to pass me to go out to the customer.
Right.
And this guy served the Mai Tai, and we had this block of ice in it, and the level of the Mai Tai, it was supposed to cover the block of ice, and this guy's Mai Tai, the level hit below the block of ice. So
right.
It was this big block of ice sticking out of the glass with liquid below it. It was like an iceberg liquid sticking out of the glass. And I remember saying to him, like, does that seem acceptable to you? I said, you've seen that picture on the front of the menu, because that's what it's meant to look like. I said, do you think that looks acceptable? And the guy, because he was prepared to serve it, we ended up, and I'm going to be brutally honest, I took it so personally that a guy would be prepared to be that dangerous with what we were trying to do, that he's almost fired over that one single thing. I mean, to be the best in the world, there's a level of discipline that you just can't go below. And the other thing, best in the world, one thing you have to know when you say you're going to be the best in the world, whatever it is, you have to know what's happening in the world. So I was well aware of what was happening in London and possibly New York even back then. And even now when we go to open the Dead Rabbit, you have to be aware of what's happening globally. You have to be aware of trends. You have to be aware of what's in and what's out, where the cocktail industry is going. And I believe at that time, we were quite ahead of the game. Back in 2006, there was very, very few bars than what we were doing.
Yeah.
That's mad. My advice is that you have to set a line where nothing can go below that line. You have to be firmly fixed in the vision of being the best in the world, and you literally have to know everything that's going on all around you.
You know, I was listening to a guy I know who's a consultant and a public speaker, and he said the job of the owner is to fight for standards. And I thought, you know, you can reach out to others to help you set those standards, but the job of the owner every day, or the operator every day, is to fight for those standards. And I, you know, that's a lot of what I hear you saying right now is, you know, if the level of the Mai Tai falls below the block of the ice, we're not serving that drink.
And the reality is the owner can't be everywhere, so you need that team. You need that team of like-minded individuals still are fighting for those standards. If you don't have those types of people around you, you're done for.
If I wasn't there, there was always somebody there. And because people believed in what I was trying to do, the staff, they would have told me every single thing that somebody done that was below the standard. I mean, my ears and eyes were everywhere in that part. And nothing would have escaped me, nothing. If it was another manager and I wasn't there, I'd have known about it the next day. I knew everything that was coming up.
You know, I recall when we opened our second restaurant and we decided that we were going to make the cocktail bar in Catherine Lombardi. We'd always done cocktails from scratch and stage left. But the bar, it's a small bar and it's a semicircle of a bar, which maximizes the amount of people who can sit at the bar, but it minimizes the amount of space you have to work behind the bar. So we always had to have a very limited cocktail menu. When we opened Catherine Lombardi in 2006, we built it as a cocktail bar with enough room to work, enough room to produce great cocktails. And I remember there were folks on our staff as we went in full on to make, you know, the best cocktail bar in New Jersey and you know, a world-class cocktail bar. And they just didn't, you know, we really had to do a lot of education, but it wasn't just education and teaching them the things we want. It's evangelism, you know what I mean? You've got to get people to believe in your dream, you know? And here sometimes we're training 19 and 20 and 21-year-old people who've never been to a great cocktail bar.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to, you know, they've got to believe, like you said, they've got to believe in you in not just the specifics, but in the vision.
I'm the sort of person, I fully, fully believe, if somebody comes in and they've got the right heart and they've got the right attitude, I want that person, I will work with that person. If it takes me months to make that person brilliant, I will do that. I'm encouraging them that this will all come to them. They'll understand everything in 6 months' time. They'll be as good as Jack is at this stuff. I just need believers. I can do the rest. I just need people who believe.
You know, we absolutely speak the same language. Listen, we need to take a quick break, but I want to come back on the other side, and I want to hear what you think is going on. You know, you said you need to know what's going on in the cocktail world. I want to hear what you think is going on in the cocktail world in general, and then I want to talk about your new bar that's opening in a couple of weeks called the Dead Rabbit in New York City. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, and we're talking with Sean Muldoon of late of the Merchant Hotel in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and soon to be of the Dead Rabbit. I think that's the most talked about cocktail bar that hasn't opened yet. What do you think is going on in the cocktail world?
I used to come over to New York on visits, like weekends here, weekends there, and I used to see a lot of real, real cool bars, places like Death and Company, places like PDT when they had opened. They were all fantastic bars, and it was very, very new. Coming here now and living here, I would say that there's a trend in New York that it's moving away from cocktails. There's a couple of places that I strongly recommend if people are serious about cocktails. I'm going to be brutally honest. My favorite cocktail bar, and talking about consistency and the level of research that goes into the drinks and talking about the quality of the bartenders, is Clover Club in Brooklyn.
Uh-huh.
I think that they take the art of cocktail making very, very seriously. But still, it's done in a neighborhood, like a neighborhood bar, and it's very, very approachable to all the people who live within. All the bars that are open now, the whole thing of waiting 20 minutes in a cocktail bar and reservation only and stuff like that, it seems to be dying a death. People want much more fun in their drinking experience now. And a lot of the bars that are open that are very, very popular and busy are the ones that maybe have four or five cocktails. They drink a lot of shots and they drink a lot of beers.
You know, can I interrupt you for 1 second? You just talked about waiting for 20 minutes for a drink. You were talking about that furniture maker who Madonna's waiting 3 years to get a piece of furniture. I thought to myself, I was at a bar last week. I think I waited 3 years for a gin and tonic.
Of course, the whole drinking experience of New York, it's like what I came here to see years ago when I came for the weekends is different than what I'm seeing now. The bars that are open, they don't seem to be taking it really, really seriously the way they did. Like the speakeasy style thing and hidden behind closed doors, maybe they're all fed up with it. I don't know. But the drinking experience seems to be you've got real fun bartenders serving shots, drinking the shots with the customers, but they're napping out four or five decent cocktails, and there are variations of classics. They're not like, there's not really been a lot of creativity within the drinks, but that seems to be what is happening in New York City at the moment, and in Manhattan anyway.
What about in London?
In London, so what has happened is, there was a scene in London in the 1990s, and then it became a bit stale. It became a bit boring, to be quite honest. And I'm going to say this very well, because it was boring, and there was nothing exciting. And now all of a sudden, what has happened is, in the last 3 or 4 years, there's been a bunch of people from Slovakia and the Czech Republic that went to catering schools in those countries, and there was a bar over in Slovakia, in Bratislava, in Slovakia, and it's called Paparazzi, and it was out a lot of years ago, and there was a guy called Stanislav Wagner. He's now a bit of a speaker, but back in the day, he was very, very influenced by Japanese bartending. He'd been to Japan, and he'd seen things that blew his mind. And he came back and started introducing that style of thing into Bratislava, pretty much what we were doing in Belfast. But he was doing, like, crystal clear ice, chopped up ice balls. He was doing homemade ingredients, homemade bitters, homemade tinctures, and it was all about service and ritual and stuff like that. And he inspired a movement of young bartenders, everybody that went to those catering colleges, would have went to his bar, and then started off as a barback. And they learned proper discipline. They learned the garnish, the drinks. It was very, very Japanese what he was teaching people. But these guys, they learned that stuff. And then they all went in, basically, to invade London. It's the best way to describe it. And these guys now, if you're looking at recent bar awards, like the recent Tales of the Cocktail and things like that, you'll see that the last few years' winners have all been hotel bars in London and other bars in London. And it's these guys that I'm talking about that were inspired by Stanislav Wagner. And they have literally... It's all about the drink and the ritual and the presentation of the drink. What goes into the drinks itself is not a million, billion percent, but it's beautiful looking, and the drinking experience is phenomenal. And these guys, mixed in with a few younger Italian sort of guys, are literally taking along in the cocktail scene to a place it's never been before. So right now, globally, the best, I would say, are definitely in London. And that's me being brutally honest, those guys, it's like a second wind. London had died a death until about 4 or 5 years ago, and then these guys went back and totally resurrected.
Well, you know, it's funny. I want to recommend two such bartenders, as you said, Italians and Eastern Europeans. And if I had two cocktail bars to recommend in London, in hotel cocktail bars, I would say Alex Curtana is the bartender you should look for at the Langham Hotel. He is phenomenal. He's won an award just recently. And Agostino Perrone is at the Connaught Hotel. And it's funny because those are the top two that come to mind, and they fall into both of those criteria you just mentioned.
And the other one would be Eric Lorenz. Savoy,
yeah.
Like Mario Mbake from Nigeria. It's all that group of people, and they're all friends. They all go drinking together and stuff like that, you know, and they do a phenomenal job. The one thing I remember about Alex Catrana, and what I've seen in that guy is the discipline, the drive. He came back from being way, way under, and every year he strived to be better. He was paying attention to what other people were doing. He was reintroducing them into his own bar.
It's funny, I went to that hotel and he blew me away immediately. I mean, we have some mutual friends, so I went there to sort of have his cocktails, and I didn't introduce myself right away. He took our drink order. I sat down with my girlfriend and a mutual friend of Mark and mine who lives in London, who we met there. And we sat down, and he presented us the menus, and then we ordered cocktails. And then he presented us with these teeny little champagne glasses that held maybe an ounce and a half, and he poured us little glasses of champagne. And I thought, what is that? And he said, it's a little amuse, which is what you do in the dining room. You know, they send you a little treat out, right? And so the cocktails were going to take a couple of minutes. But in the meantime, we had, you know, an ounce of champagne.
It's the answer to cocktails taking 5 minutes. You know, it's the answer to having to wait for precisely made drinks.
But it was also that special touch, that four-star touch that was unexpected and delightful. You know, that's somebody who thought long and hard about the experience of sitting at the bar. I thought that was phenomenal.
You're talking about the first time I ever seen that was actually at the Connaught, and it was Algo Perrone, it's his sort of idea, and he serves a non-alcoholic cocktail to everybody that walks in. But it was that notion that Alex seen, and Alex then went and spoke to champagne company, the other house pouring champagne guys, and he basically made a deal with those, blah, 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 whatever it was. And he's now in a position where he has taken that idea and made it better.
Sean, one of the things you said before was you said that these bartenders, their style is very Japanese. What did you mean exactly when you said their style was very Japanese?
Okay, so I had to go to Japan myself to see this because serious cocktail bartenders were putting on blogs and sending me emails saying that it's a place in the world. They said two places in the world would inspire somebody like me, as in the movement that's happening out there and what people are doing. One was Melbourne in Australia, and the other one was Ginza in Japan, and there's another area outside of Tokyo, if I can remember. I'll probably come back to me. Japanese bartenders, apparently what Japanese bartenders do, or Japanese people do, is that, again, going back to the Alex idea, they see something that happened somewhere else and make it better in their own country. But Japanese bartending is different. Apparently during Prohibition, American bartenders showed Japanese bartenders how to bartend. And I was talking to Japanese bartenders, and these guys have told me this. And Japanese bartenders did not move on from what they were taught. So when you go to a Japanese bar now, it literally is like being in a time warp, like a prohibition time warp. These guys are not pretending to be speakeasies or anything. These bartenders are genuinely, that's the way they are. It's ingrained in them. Everything is about ritual. Everything is about the service. So when you walk in, the first thing that happens is somebody's there to greet you and take your coat. The second thing to do when you sit at the table is to give you a hand towel, like a warm hand towel to dry your hands. And then the menu, sometimes it'll be a menu, sometimes there won't be a menu. The menu is eight drinks, something like that, and these guys only do classics. There's no innovation. There's no weird and wonderful concoctions you would see in all these other places. It's all strictly like drinks from the 1930s, like a Tom Collins or whatever it is. And what would happen is the glass would be beautiful. The way the guy stirs is just fantastic. It's mesmerizing the technique that he uses, the way he shakes. It's mesmerizing to watch. The way he stirs it in the glass, it's just beautiful. The glass is beautiful. There's no straws. They don't serve straws with anything. Very, very little garnishes. The only time that I've ever seen a garnish in a drink was in a dry martini, which had an olive in it. I didn't see a garnish in any other drink that I had because they don't believe in that sort of stuff. It really is like being transported into another place.
There are a lot of people doing things in cocktails right now that are innovative, flashy, very dramatic things to happen behind a bar. There's a stage now where people are trying to come up with something new just to get attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what people want now is a really great bar that's hospitable and either part of a restaurant or not, but a place where you go to have fun that also has great cocktails. That's our philosophy anyway.
The only place I've seen that actually gets a name, like properly gets a name for that sort of, those type of drinks, is the place, is it Aviary or something in Chicago? Is that where it is?
Aviary, yeah.
It's a fine dining restaurant. Like, I mean, in the cocktail world, what people are actually saying, yes, they do have a lot of respect for that place. But it's the only place that I know it seems to be doing it well. Molecular sort of stuff, the fancy, the really super fancy stuff. I don't believe in it personally. It's not what I want when I go drinking.
It's interesting, but it doesn't feed the soul. You know, I mean, it does not.
What a cocktail bar is, for me, I believe a cocktail bar is, it's just a place that you want to go to a couple of times a week.
Yeah.
It's not a place you want to visit once a year.
Yeah.
And those molecular gastronomy places are the places I want to visit once a year.
So, Sean, you're about to open the Dead Rabbit in New York City. So what's your vision for the Dead Rabbit? What's this place going to be? How's it going to be different from any other bar in New York?
Say, I've been bartending and working in bars and managing bars, whatever it is, for 21 years now. This inventor, but he came into the Merchant. He was a regular customer in the Merchant, and he spent 5 weeks over here and 1 week over in Belfast. That's the way he worked his job with. He believes that if we had done the Merchant in New York, that the opportunity that we would have got a result would have been much, much more than what we could get in Belfast.
I agree.
So he believes by coming to New York, doors of opportunity could potentially open for what we were doing. And that was the whole plan. And he said to me, listen, you're the guy, come up with an idea. He said, this has got to be a timeless bar. He said, it can't be something that's here today and gone tomorrow. And there's two things that inspired me to do the concept that we're doing. We had a connoisseurs club in Belfast in the Merchant Hotel, but our general manager turned around to me one day and said, why don't we have an actual connoisseurs club? And his example was, I mean, why don't we have a club where the staff can learn about the spirits that they're selling, and you can get somebody like the master distiller of Bushmills whiskey down to talk to our staff, to our customers. And that way, customers don't know what they're buying and staff don't know what they're selling. Instead of just having all these beautiful spirits behind the bar, let's actually encourage the sale of these spirits and the buying of these. And then it developed, and I'll tell you why it developed. We went to Tales of the Cocktail, and we were up for 3 awards. And we lost all 3. This was like the first time we were ever entered in Tales of the Cocktail. We lost all 3. And I remember thinking at the time, going back to the same thing, how do I do better than that guy, the guy that inspired me? The secret is to get all the judges to the hotel. Belfast, he says, nobody's ever been to your hotel. Nobody knows much about your hotel. He says, you've got to bring that experience to their doors. And that's what that whole thing, the connoisseurs club, I decided I need to make this global. I need to get big names over here. They come over. They've done their thing, and that's basically how all these people in New York got to hear about the Merchant Hotel was through the Connoisseurs Club.
That's fascinating.
The thing is, yeah. So the following year, after losing all 3 the year previous, we won all 3 the following year. So it seemed to have paid off. But the other thing about the Connoisseurs Club was these people will be invited over, the Americans, and they loved our bar, and they sat and drank cocktails in our bar, and they had this 5-star experience, but they also loved a pub up the street, and the pub up the street was an Irish bar, and it had a big Irish whiskey selection, and that sold beer. We didn't sell beer, and it was a real darn, like a working man's pub, tavern, but it was done well, and the pub was called the Duke of York. And I remember thinking the thing that amazed me, we were paying all this money to get these people over and to impress them with all our fancy stuff, but they actually loved going to this pub up the street. And I remember thinking, if I was ever to create a bar, it has to combine both of those concepts. It has to create the pub. I have to have a pub and I have to have the cocktails because I don't want to lose my, I don't want to leave these people again to a pub.
Right.
So I need to make our pub part of the concept. The other thing was there was a restaurant in Belfast called Dean's. It's a 1-star Michelin restaurant, and he used to have the whole place as a Michelin star restaurant. He realized he wasn't making money every night of the week on fine dining food. So he turned the downstairs into a brasserie, which was much more affordable, and it was packed all the time. And then upstairs, he lived his dream. He had his fine dining restaurant, Michelin star restaurant, and it was only open from Wednesday to Saturday. And he would have cooked the food, and he would have had that fancy experience. So there was the two things that happened. There was the fact that in his restaurant, downstairs was reality, and upstairs was the dream.
Right.
And so that was part of it. And I thought, and the other part was that you could work. And the Merchant, I believe that the Merchant was the dream and the Duke of York was the reality. So I thought, okay, so I'm going to do dual concept. We're going to do the fancy cocktails we do, but we also need to have another form of enticement. We need to get them in some other way. Dual concept, pub and cocktail. We want to do 1850 style cocktails. I thought Jerry Thomas, I thought, first cocktail that ever written in New York, 1862. So I thought that we're thinking that here. And I knew at the time there was a lot of Irish immigrants. 1 million people came through the port of New York, which is where South Street Seaport is now. And I believed I had an Irish connection that was happening in New York. I had a cultural connection that was happening in New York. And I believed that for me to come and do the dual concept in New York, I needed to have a story that was believable. You can't just have a cocktail bar in a pub. It doesn't make sense. So you need to have a story. And I thought when I came and I said, I've got to marry these two ideas, these two concepts, I've got to bring them together and make it in a very valuable in a way that New Yorkers will understand. And we looked at the addresses and the buildings that the bartenders worked in, and a lot of them were actually working downtown Manhattan, specifically between Bowling Green and City Hall on Broadway. There was a lot of fancy hotel bars. Jerry Thomas's first bar was here in 1852, and we realized there was actually two things happening in the financial district, what is now the financial district of Manhattan. Those two things happened, two coexisting ones. We had a cocktail movement that was happening on Broadway, and we had the Irish immigrants coming in on the port of New York. And we looked at those Irish immigrants more, and we looked at the bars that they would have drank in, and they were immigrant taverns. They were basically, a lot of the Irish were very, very poor. They came off the Fallons, if they were lucky to even survive the journey. They were drinking in what we call immigrant taverns. So I thought we've actually got an amazing story here, because we're talking mid-19th century. We had an Irish thing that was happening, and we had a cocktail thing that was happening. And I thought, we can definitely make this story believable, because we can have the immigrant tavern in town as part of our bar, and we have the cocktail part upstairs. And that's how the Dead Rabbit was born.
And so the Dead Rabbit now is its own building, right? It's a townhouse. We have four stories?
And we found a building that was created in 1828. And very, very lucky, it's a five-story townhouse, and it's in the area that our story actually belongs. So finding that building was very, very, very fortunate on our behalf.
Wow. What is your place going to look like? What do we expect when we go to the Dead Rabbit? We have a casual tap room downstairs, and are we fancy schmancy upstairs?
So I would have researched every single element of what these rooms should look like, and what sort of artifacts and what sort of paintings and stuff like that we should have in these rooms. Downstairs, the tap room will have 14 beers and draft, heavy, heavy draft beer, Irish whiskey. A tap room, an immigrant tavern back then, would have had a long bar. It would have had sawdust on the floor, and it would have had no seats. This room is designed for that style of bar. It's a very, very narrow room. We're going to make it look very, very 1850. It's going to have a lot of pictures on the walls. We've got a mural that's been, we've commissioned an artist to do a mural, a Civil War era mural. It's been finished as we speak. We're going to have tables, seats for lunch only, and then we're taking all the seats out at night time. So it's going to be a standing bar. And that's what would have, like a McSorley's type of place.
Sure, sure. I mean, like so many of the bars in New York were for so long. They were play taverns in the afternoon and then bars at night.
And that'll be standing. That'll be busy. Downstairs is reality. Upstairs is the dream. Upstairs is what we do. Upstairs is the level of service that we're used to, coming from the merchant stuff like that. Everything sit down. We have a ragtime piano. The two rooms will look like they're part of the same building. It'll not be like you're leaving one building and getting another building. We don't have any sort of rules and regulations at all. No dress codes. We just want people. We're trying to make cocktails approachable to everybody. Normal bars will have these rules and regulations. You've got to be this. You've got to be that. We're basically saying we have a brass plaque on our outside wall, basically saying that we welcome absolutely everybody in our doors. The only thing we don't want is somebody to be rude or loud or obnoxious. I mean, that's the one thing we'll not tolerate. We just basically want cocktails to be approachable. We have 72 drinks in our menu broken into 12 categories. So there's 6 drinks per category. 30 of those drinks are wine and beer based. And wine and beer based cocktails are like $11. So we're making things very affordable. Punch is going to be a big punch bowl, and the punch bowl service is going to be a very, very big focus on what we do upstairs. Punch bowls can go from 4 people to 8 people.
That's pretty cool. You know, I have to say, I was thinking about that list, the plaque that says absolutely everybody is welcome. Be sure you leave a little space under that plaque, because you might want to have a little except for, and then just put people on one at a time as you throw them out. You know, that would be a mark of some sort of honor to get on the... Well, Sean, when are you going to open?
Between Christmas and the New Year.
DeadRabbitNYC.com. You can find out more about the Dead Rabbit. Sean, best of luck with everything. We'll see you shortly after.
Thanks,
you open.
Thanks, Sean. Enjoy your opening.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back in just a moment. Stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. I love that guy.
He's Irish. Of course you love him. Okay.
Are you accusing me of nepotism?
I'm just going to say, I haven't seen the Italian Cocktailian.
I love a lot of Augustino Perrone.
On the show? No, not yet.
All right. No, there's a little bit of nepotism there, but I can't wait for the Dead Rabbit in New York City. I really am. It sounds like a totally. First of all, I love the idea of a standing bar downstairs, mm-hmm. totally casual, very old school. And you know what? I've seen Sean's work before. I know it's going to be fun and interesting. And you know, there's a whole bunch of cool stuff going on in the cocktail world. And a lot about what he said was, all these places you go to now, all the cool places, Joaquin Simo at Pouring Ribbons, mm-hmm. you know, they're friendly and they're not. Yeah. We are done with the mystique of the faux speakeasy too, and it's not oppressively cool either. It's just a great quality bar. I can't wait for that to open.
It's exciting. It's exciting time in New York now. New York all of a sudden has a few new cocktail bars opening, you know, this year. Over this past year, we've seen some really cool places open between Nomad and Pouring Ribbons and the Dead Rabbit.
I understand that was one of the slogans that they didn't use.
Nomad, Nomad.
Nomad, not bad. That's really, they didn't use that? All right, well, I hope you guys, except for the last few minutes, I hope you guys have enjoyed the hour as much as we certainly have. I'm Francis Chutt.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We're the Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com.